Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magus Teevil. Joining me in the studio today are
Peter R.H.
and Stephen Fan.
And we got a great, good show for you lined up today. Today is the first day of Fund Drive, and we are, in fact, the first show of Fund Drive. If you don't know what Fund Drive is, Fund Drive is our annual fundraising campaign where we ask listeners like you to support the station in all the things we do throughout the year. We are a community radio station. We focus our programming on community. We are a nonprofit. We get a bunch of funding from the students here at SFU, but of course we don't serve just SFU or the students at SFU. We serve the entire Vancouver community and region. And that's where you come in as a listener, a community listener. We're looking to you to help support the station and what we do, and we need your help. Running a radio station is not a cheap affair, and we have some big expenses coming up. We're going to be replacing our transmitting tower sometime this fall. It's going to cost a whack load of money. We are working hard to expand our community news reporting so that we can serve you better as a community. And you know, the other part of our funding I mentioned from students hasn't changed in a lot of years, so we're feeling the pinch of that. And that's where you can come in and help us out. So please make a contribution to the station. You can go to our donation page, which is at cjsf.ca/donate. Or if you like, you can text donate to our number here, 778-782-2573. That's 778-782-2573. Text the word donate to that, and you will get a text back with a link to the donation page. You can go there and make a donation, $35, $50, $70. If you donate at the $90 and 10 cent level, you will get a really nice limited edition print. You can go and see that on our website, on our Fund Drive website at cjsffunddrive.ca. So please go to the website, support your community radio so we can come back to you here every week with all the programming we have throughout the week. That would be amazing. And I'd really urge you to do that. Now our goal is $10,000, and we're really excited to be doing this fundraising drive this week and are looking for your support. So please head to the website, cjsf.ca/donate, to make a donation right now. All right, we got a bunch of stuff lined up for you on the show today. We have a report from Danny Nesvadarani about efforts to bring in a bylaw in Burnaby to discourage folks from feeding wildlife, and all because that creates a lot of problems. Stephen Fan is here, and we're going to be talking about tariffs and stuff.
Yeah, just the world economic issues to some extent, I think.
And those, of course, top of mind today because the ongoing tariff war between the United States and most of the rest of the country. But we're kind of in the thick of it here in Canada.
And it's an existential issue for Canada as well.
It is.
And Peter? So, actually, I'm going to bring up something that it's not going to be this. I'm going to do on media. I went to a an event by the communications department in SFU, and I'm going to be talking about how sometimes in the internet it's hard to get the right information. You have to be wary of that, and a few other things about media. I got something on Time magazine here, but this is something I just heard on Sunday. Yep. That Canada and the Philippines sign a status of visiting forces agreement. And I just heard it actually on CBC Radio on Sunday morning. And I didn't have really much of a chance to sort of do any background on it. The Philippines is sort of a involved situation. A lot of Canadian mining firms are exploiting them, I feel. So this is actually quite new. This is from the Government of Canada news release, November 2nd. So this is November 3rd. Today, that was on a Sunday, the Canadian Minister of National Defense and the Philippine Secretary of National Defense signed a status of visiting forces agreement between Canada and the Philippines. This agreement builds on the Canada-Philippines Defense Cooperation Memorandum of Understanding signed in January 2024.
So you're going to talk more about that later, too?
Maybe a little bit. I just have what's on the thing there.
Okay. Great. That's coming up in the last 15 minutes of the show. And, of course, just after the half hour, we have Gardening with Embark. All that more coming up here on Speak Up here on CJSF. We're going to start the program off, though, with a report from Danny Nesvadarani about Burnaby Council being solicited to create a bylaw to manage feeding of wildlife by Burnaby residents and the problems it causes.
The Fur Bearers are a Canada-wide nonprofit based in British Columbia that focuses on the welfare of wildlife and how humans and animals can more sustainably coexist. On September 25th, the organization sent a letter to Burnaby City Council highlighting the need for a wildlife feeding bylaw in the city of Burnaby. This letter was supported by Simon Fraser University, which recently reported over 100 complaints filed on its Burnaby campus regarding raccoon behavior and activity in the last 2 years. They attribute these complaints to persistent feeding of the raccoons by some of the general public on campus, and while the university has claimed to have utilized numerous educational tools to communicate the importance of not feeding wildlife, its current methods are not having the desired effect. For this reason, the Fur Bearers, alongside SFU, are advocating for a bylaw to be passed that would allow for enforcement action to address the issue of wildlife feedings on campus and throughout the city of Burnaby. To learn more about the bylaw, as well as what this proposed enforcement may look like, CJSF spoke with Tiana Selleck, the Fur Bearers Wildlife Campaigns and Advocacy Manager, on how this bylaw proposal came to be.
So this is something that both the Fur Bearers and SFU itself are really behind. The university has let us know they've received over 100 complaints in the past 2 years about people feeding raccoons on campus. Our organization has also had community members reach out to us for support. Like you mentioned, lots of students on campus who are encountering wildlife, witnessing feeding events. And then there have also been unfortunate incidents nearby, like the black bear that was killed near SFU in September after becoming food conditioned. So these are all really clear examples of how feeding creates problems. So by supporting our call for a municipal bylaw, SFU is essentially recognizing the importance of equipping the city with a necessary mechanism to help them address the issue.
Next, we asked what they hope this bylaw is able to accomplish.
So the goal here really is to change behavior. Typically, enforcement starts with education-based warnings. So giving people a chance to understand why feeding wildlife is harmful and adjust their actions accordingly. And what we hope is that once people understand that feeding of wildlife does pose risks and harms these animals long term, we're hoping that the behavior changes. But if it continues, the bylaw would give officers the ability to issue tickets as a deterrent to stop that behavior before it escalates into a bigger issue like we saw with that bear. So right now the city is relying on education alone, and it hasn't been successful in solving the problem. So this next step of enforcement is essentially just providing a necessary tool to shift that behavior in a way that will protect both the community and the wildlife within it.
Afterwards, we discuss what some of the negative effects are when it comes to feeding wildlife, whether it be on SFU's Burnaby campus or throughout the city.
So the biggest thing is feeding wildlife, whether that's directly or indirectly by leaving food out. It's teaching these animals to rely on people for food. They're also losing their natural and, frankly, necessary caution of us, which can lead them to bolder and riskier behavior, such as approaching people for food in the future, approaching people's homes, that sort of thing. Additionally, other wildlife may be drawn into the area, resulting in overcrowding, like you mentioned, lots of wildlife on the campus. Also, increased disease transmission from us to them and vice versa. And ultimately a higher likelihood of negative human-wildlife encounters that unfortunately often end fatally for the animals involved. So it's just, it's unsafe for both people and wildlife long-term.
At the end of our conversation, Tiana Selleck left us with this piece of advice.
So we understand that the intention often comes from a good place, and feeding wildlife might feel like it's helping, but it really does harm animals. It's putting them at risk of injury, malnutrition, disease, and ultimately being destroyed. So true compassion means doing what's best for the animal long term, and the best way to care for wildlife is to let them stay wild. So what people can do that will make a really big difference is giving wildlife their space, not leaving food unattended on campus or in parks, properly storing away their garbage and their compost, and removing any attractants like pet food or bird feeders, that sort of thing. So really important not to feed them intentionally or unintentionally and to allow them to stay wild. And what we would really encourage people to do is continue to enjoy wildlife, but in a way that's compassionate and respectful. So this could be things like birding, volunteering with local rescues, engaging in citizen science initiatives, and supporting wildlife-friendly policies. So lots of great ways to enjoy wildlife that ensure safe coexistence for us and for them down the line.
Once again, that was our conversation with Tiana Selleck, the Wildlife Campaigns and Advocacy Manager for the Fur Bears, who are currently advocating for a wildlife feeding bylaw in the city of Burnaby. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
So the Local Journalism Initiative is one of the funding sources that CJSF relies on, and it particularly funds our local reporter, and allowing us to expand our community coverage. We also rely on support from other grants that we apply for, and the support of SFU students. But we're also looking at you, our listeners, you listening at home right now, for support as well. As a community radio station, we aim to serve the community and provide a kind of programming and a kind of radio that isn't available elsewhere. And I think we do a really good job of that. There's a lot of extraordinary programs here on CJSF that are worth listening to. And it takes resources to bring that to you. Money resources, of course, and that's where you can help us out with a donation today. But also people resources. We have a small staff here, but also a large crew of volunteers who put in their time every week to bring you great programming in the studio today. Our two volunteers, Stephen Fan and Peter R.H., who are here giving of themselves to bring you information and programming that hopefully you are enjoying. So you can make a donation today by going to our donation page, cjsf.ca/donate, or send us a text at 778-782-2573. Text us the word donate to that number. That's 782-CJSF on your keypad. You will get a text back with a link to the donation page, and you can go there and make a donation right now. We'd love to see a donation of $100 or $120 if you can afford that. We're here every week, and if you're listening on the regular, we'd love to get your support. All right, Stephen Fan,
Yeah, so I think some interesting events have taken place with regard to U.S.-Canadian trade relations. I think everyone's kind of aware that, you know, Doug Ford did his thing, you know, ran that ad.
Yep, ran an ad using Ronald Reagan to, well, Ronald Reagan's words about his position on tariffs.
Yes. Me and Magnus talked about that last week, and we ran the entire five-minute radio address. It used to be that Reagan at least did it every week for about 5 minutes.
We
ran the entire thing.
Yeah.
I think there are some different angles to this, because I think the mainstream analysis of this stuff is, in my view, somewhat erroneous and not misguided, but tends to sensationalize why I think Trump reacted the way he did. I think there are some very specific angles here. The first thing is, okay, I got to illustrate this with a moment where Trump was on Air Force One and some reporter was asking him about the ad, and Trump is like, you know, I knew Ronald Reagan, you know, Ronald Reagan loved tariffs, and obviously that's like, true. That's not true. But why did Trump react so suddenly and so strongly against this particular slight and in such an escalatory fashion? And by which I mean that when he initially saw it that Wednesday night, he was like, oh, you know, I don't agree with it, but I understand why the Canadians are doing what they're doing. And then suddenly the next day it was like, we're canceling the negotiations, we're slapping a 10% tariff on Canada. And a friend of mine who actually studies this stuff, he's a political strategist in the United States for the Democratic Party. He messaged me and he was like, look, this is the Reagan ad became explosive not because it was like anti-tariffs or used Reagan's words, but it touched a very fundamental and you could argue existential issue for Trump of party management, right? In the sense that Trump has very successfully gotten the entirety of the Republican Party, more or less, to line up behind him, behind his MAGA, Make America Great Again program, his America First program. And here is, you know, like Doug Ford, you know, pretty sure not knowing what he's doing, but, you know, he's like bumping around, announcing this, doing this sort of like, you could say a pincer movement of like, we're going to use a Republican, you know, demigod's words against Trump. Well, there's a real risk of splitting his coalition.
Right.
And that's a very existential risk to Trump in a way, you know, I disagree with, quote-unquote, I disagree with President Trump on tariffs is not.
Well, it sort of highlights the very sudden shift that the Republican Party under Trump has made on the position of tariffs, because the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and more broadly the whole Western sort of political consensus has really shifted towards, for the most part, free trade,
to some extent,
the last 40 years.
In the broad sense, yes.
Yeah.
But obviously in the last, I would say, 8 or so years, there's been a shift in, you could call it the U.S. establishment regards to, in terms of trade with China and so forth. But I agree with you, there's a broad consensus in terms of freer trade. I think the problem comes in not necessarily on trade, but on related issues, right? In the sense that Trump has been able to suppress a lot of dissent in the United States regarding his leadership, essentially by using a lot of the existing structure to clamp down on it. I think to the extent, you know, someone could like essentially use Canada as a cipher to do all these things, to essentially use Reagan's words against Trump. Well, what stops Bill Kristol or Victoria Nuland from using Canada as a cipher on Ukraine, on national security, on Europe, on China? The list goes on. There's like once you succeed in one specific instance of this side kind of maneuver, pincer movement in endeavor, it's a very genuine risk for Trump. So I think Trump was rational. I don't endorse it, but he was rational to react as he did. I know one of the rare moments of rationality in his presidency, actually. But and this is like infuriating to us, to Canadians. But I cannot see how he could have acted any other way if he was to persist with his program. Because, you know, like there are a lot of very unhappy never Trumpers within the Republican Party. you know, it's not that hard for them to call up Doug Ford and run another ad on TV about this or that. It's just not that hard. So, and that was kind of my angle on this.
Couldn't they do this themselves, though? I mean, you know, if in the scale of U.S. fundraising, $75 million isn't that much political fundraising.
It's not about the sums. It's the fact, for example, CBS is currently undergoing merger review by the Justice Department regarding by acquisition by Paramount.
Yeah.
So they have been very careful not only to broadcast Trump-friendly content, but also not to broadcast Trump-unfriendly content. But obviously, the semi-sovereign government of Ontario doing this stuff, it's just kind of a different set of questions. It's kind of a different kind of worms. And it's just like a different order of problems. That's one issue. The other issue, and this doesn't have anything to do with Trump, but it is related to the trade discussions, is I have a friend who's a hedge fund manager who monitors this stuff very, very closely because U.S.-Canadian trade relations is a big part of what he covers. And he messaged me in the middle of this. He pointed me to a clip saying by Doug Ford being interviewed by TV reporters, and the reporter was asking him, hey, Danielle Smith is not reacting against these. She's not running these ads. And Doug Ford very specifically was like, hey, she doesn't have the auto industry to lose. She doesn't have the steel and aluminum manufacturing industry to lose. She doesn't have, in his words, life sciences industries to lose. Now, I do think he's exaggerating, but I think he actually gets
it. It's already we're seeing the effect on the auto industry.
Yeah, I do. It is having an effect on the auto industry. But actually, I think the most illustrative example is the closure of furniture factories, both in Vancouver and Delta, for example, and also recently, like last week in Toronto, in suburban Toronto. And I think this gets at a fundamental tension that's existed at the heart of NAFTA or CUSMA or whatever it is for really like its entire existence, which is that NAFTA really has like three, it's like a stool that has three legs. Yeah. The first leg is free trade, like goods and services can enter freely between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. The second one is free movement of capital. So investors can, from any of the three countries, can invest in any of the other three countries. And there's a fair and reasonable, equitable adjudication process if investor assets were to be seized. The third part of the stool, and this is the part that has really worked out least well for Canada, is supply chain integration. Supply chain integration, you know, the word supply chain has been thrown around a lot, but what it means is that, like, I can have a car that's kind of, you know, partly assembled in Canada and moves across the border to Detroit, gets, you know, painted, and then moves back to Canada again to get the engine installed and back and forth. Like, during the Brexit discussions, one thing they pointed out was, like, if you look at the Guinness factory, it moves across the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, like, 1,000 times before it gets finished.
This is to make...
Just to make a can of beer or a car or whatever. So that is very different from just, like, free trade where, like, I ship you an iPad.
There's one tariff transaction when you ship a finished product. But here we're moving back and forth.
And I think to some extent, this is kind of deep Ottawa lore, and partly this is just speculative. I think the opinion in sort of elite Ottawa has been for quite some time now, really at least a decade, that supply chain integration doesn't really work. And, you know, we'll keep going with it if that's what the Americans want. But if the Americans want to give us an out, we should take the out. And what I mean by this is it's fairly profound, right? Like, in the sense that there's two things to consider, and I'll be very quick about it. The first thing is the logic of supply chain integration is really different places in the value chain, right? So in the auto sector, the idea is that Mexico will do some of the lower value stuff, Canada will do some of the mid-value stuff, and a lot of the really high-value stuff will get done in America.
Right.
Because wages are a little bit lower in Canada, but also healthcare costs are substantially lower in Canada. So it's just like there's a cost advantage. Right. But, of course, the problem is that as Canadians, we never get to move up to the top end of the supply chain. So, for example, Magna International, which is the biggest auto parts supplier in the world, it is a Canadian company, they do really advanced subcontracting assembly for BMW entire model lines in Austria, in Europe, in their European operations. They don't get to do any of that in Canada or the United States because, again, there's such segregation in value engineering that Canada doesn't get.
So as a concern, well, we got a call coming in, but...
yeah, please.
Well, I'm not going to take it on. I can't take it right on air, but we will... take a brief break. Here's, and we'll return to this conversation with a question of what is the downside to supply side or supply chain
integration?
Yeah, there's
a second thing as well. Yeah.
This is Bird Note. The sights and sounds of birds visiting a feeder in the backyard or a local park can brighten our days during the darker months of the year. And if you want to take your experience to the next level, you can contribute to science just by keeping track of birds at a feeder. Project Feeder Watch is a community science project organized by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Birds Canada. Thousands of people across North America help gather data on over 100 species of birds that spend their winters on the continent. From November through April, participants make lists of the birds they see at a bird feeder, bird-friendly garden, or water feature whenever they get the chance, and submit those lists online. It's that simple. You might think an activity so simple couldn't possibly make a difference. But the data from Project Feeder Watch have already helped sound the alarm about declines in bird species, track the spread of disease among wintering bird flocks, and note shifts in the ranges of bird species throughout the colder months. Through efforts like Project Feeder Watch, we can become the eyes and ears of bird conservation. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Rimmel. BirdNote is grateful to all listeners who provide financial support for this show. You can join them at birdnote.org.
All right, and we're back. And that is our first donation of the show. So thank you to that caller. We'll thank you by name in a few minutes when they've finished taking that information. So that's really exciting. We are in the middle of Fund Drive here at CJSF. It starts today and runs all week through Sunday, November 9th. And we'd love it if you call or go to our website, cjsffunddrive.ca, where you can find more information about the fund drive this year and what we're asking for and how you can make a donation. So please hit the phone or hit that website. And we'd be happy to do it. So we're going to pick up our conversation. We are right in the middle there, Stephen, of talking about what is the downsides of
supply chain integration under NAFTA.
Supply chain integration under NAFTA. And so what is the Ottawa elite see as?
Thank you so much for your donation.
Here we go. What do you see as? The downside here? Are they concerned that we're being cut out of that sort of better end of?
The problem with supply chain integration is that you can only do it once.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is that in the European Union, for example, the European Union is the single most integrated macro major economic entity, supranational international entity in the world, and it means, for example, in auto manufacturing that a German manufacturer would always have to go to Poland or Czechia first and vice versa. Now, in the context of Canada, what that means is that it really privileges domestic big three auto manufacturers for the auto sector because it kind of essentially locks out the international manufacturers. Like, to some extent, Toyota and Honda have established operations in North America. But
they're mostly just assembly plants.
They're mostly assembly plants, but they, to some extent, in successive negotiations, the U.S. administration have actually really tremendously privileged the big three of Detroit. Now, traditionally, this was not such a problem in the sense that the North American auto market is generally considered the most lucrative auto market in the world. And the big three are strong, they're well capitalized, they have good technology. Well, I don't know if any of these things are true anymore. Like, it's the problem is the big three, they're not really at the leading edge of technology and haven't been for a while, right? They have been not at the leading edge of technology for fuel-efficient internal combustion vehicles against the Japanese manufacturers for at least a decade, if not more. And they're definitely not at the cutting edge regarding electric vehicles.
Yeah.
In regard to Chinese competitors like BYD and Xiaomi, for example.
Yeah.
So if you have so much supply chain integration, what it means is that effectively, it's impossible for BYD to come to Canada and set up an auto plant. And one thing that's been lurking beneath the surface, and even the Chinese side, the Chinese embassy, have been very reluctant to openly discuss this, is that China is not really just offering, you know, like to drop its canola tariffs in exchange for dropping Canada, dropping this 100% EV tariffs on China. China is has been kind of inching toward offering to build a Canadian supply chain system for BYD, at least for its Canadian market, if not its North American market, broader market, international markets, because it recognizes that Canada has a big auto industry and this is something that's valuable to us. So until and unless we actually, to some extent, exit ourselves from NAFTA's deep supply chain integration on the auto sector, it's actually impossible for us to do this. So because the terms just don't line up.
Right. So what would the alternative be then?
I think
what arrangement would we need to keep the auto industry and the degree of cooperation back and forth across the border, which seems to be key to it, without falling into this trap?
Yeah. So that's kind of the big trap, and it's the challenge. And this is also why the federal government has been very tight-lipped on it throughout. I think there's two things you can do here. The first thing is to understand that, to some extent, Big Three is just simply in secular decline, right? You know, like I think Stellantis slash Chrysler closed a plant in Canada. I think it's very unlikely they're going to build more plants, but it is not unlikely that they will close more plants. So I think you have to think, you know, over the period of the next several decades, the Big Three are simply in decline. The second thing you have to look at, really, the big Canadian auto sector success stories, and that's Frank Stronach and Magna International. You know, he arrived in Canada as a 16-year-old Austrian apprentice and built a company that has become the leading auto parts supplier in the world and does basically sub-assembly, entire assemblies actually, in Europe for BMW and so on. And the key here is to really specialize in specific things and just absolutely have a monopoly in these things,
right?
Very specific parts. I think with regard to the existing or previous Canadian auto sector strategy, it was to kind of put a lot of money, we're talking tens of billions of dollars of tax incentives, into supporting EV battery factories, because batteries are kind of the future core, the heart of the EV sector. That has just not been successful. Northvolt, which is the European manufacturer that has promised to build a plant in Canada, that has literally filed for bankruptcy, and it just hasn't worked out. I think you kind of have to have that discussion about, could we get BYD to line up, for example, with Magna, with other Canadian auto parts suppliers, where there is a sustainable value chain, not just in terms of direct manufacturing in Canada, but also for viable Canadian companies that create value and for these value to stay in Canada.
So would that be creating some sort of cooperation between Chinese EV companies
and Canadian auto parts suppliers
as part of a deal to reduce what is now, I think, a 300% tariff?
100% tariff.
Okay.
But it's just same as in the United States, 100% tariffs. Although I think the way Xiaomi is going, it probably could be competitive even with 100% tariffs.
Yeah.
So it might be going up. But the problem, the issue I see here is essentially, they're going to have to work out a way. So for Canada, for the Canadian auto industry to fit into the global EV ecosystem, which a lot of decision makers think is going to become a key part, if not the key part, of auto manufacturing going forward. I want to add one more note. I think the auto sector directly employs 100,000 people in Canada and indirectly employs anywhere between, depends on how you count it, like 500,000 people to 1 million people in Canada. It is a very substantial economic sector in Canada. It is not easy to make these long-term calculations. And I think to some extent, the exit Trump was offering Canada on this, in terms of the integrated auto sector, integrated steel and aluminum sector, integrated forestry sector, was a fairly dignified one, and one that was kind of fairly gradual, and sort of a gradual step down over, you know, a decade or more. And I think this is why Ottawa kind of is now weirdly aligned more with Trump, and then, you know, Doug Ford and David Eby's on the other side.
Can I weigh in a few comments?
Very quickly. Yeah. We got about a minute here, Peter.
Well, one thing is that the issue is that, first of all, Jimmy Carter, as I said last week, made it that all comments by a president is in the public domain. And we went over that. The whole address, he said, they were placing tariffs on Japan because they had broken certain regulations or whatever. So they were not. It was not in out of context. It was above board, and that the Reagan Institute was, as I was saying last week, they're going more for what the current Americana is than the true legacy of Ronald Reagan. Now, one last thing I'm going to want to bring up is
very quickly though
is in the OOs, didn't all the Metroit just end just about, like they were closing down the factories and so on? What happened to that?
Whatever it is, it's not good things. And the other thing I would add one sentence is that just because you can do certain things regarding Ronald Reagan's wars and so forth, and just because they're true, does not make them wise actions.
We have the right to do it. I'm for Doug Ford doing it.
Okay,
myself.
Thanks, Peter. And that's the kind of passionate opinion you get here on CJSF. We are in the middle of Fun Drive. We're in the middle of Fun Drive, and we've got our first donations on this show. We're up to about $700 towards our $10,000 goal so far. With some donations that came in prior to the drive, which is a good start for 10:30 a.m. on the first day of the drive. So thank you to everyone who's donated so far, and thank you to our caller who just made a donation. That's really wonderful. Those of you who are out there thinking about it, now's a great time to jump on your phone or your computer and make a donation at cjsf.ca/donate, or you can find more information about the drive and what we're doing and where your money will go at cjsffunddrive.ca. You can give us a call, although it's a little difficult to take them in the middle of the show, but we'll manage. Okay, time for Gardening with Embark, and then we'll be back with Peter's commentary on media coming up in about 10 minutes or so. Time now for Gardening with Embark, and joining me in the studio is our gardens expert, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So things are really winding down in the garden, and it's kind of time to think about how to end out the season and get things ready for a bit of a break, perhaps.
Yes, as you mentioned, and we've been talking over the last few weeks, the work in the garden is slowly down. We have put the garden to bed for the winter, and we have done our janitorial work activities to make sure that everything is clean around before the first snow comes or the first frost. And now it's time to as well focus on the tools. Here in Bark, we have storage boxes made of wooden slats, and so, which are not waterproof. So we need to just start cleaning.
So they're fine for the summer and through the season to put things away and keep them safe. But
yes, they are during the winter, on fall and winter, there is too much water going through. And so the old handles with our shovels and forks get wet and they destroy. So we just cleaning the metal bits and bring all the tools indoors. So for the winter. Yeah. The same with the hand towels as well. We just clean, make a good clean, put a bit of oil to protect from rust, and bring them indoors too.
What sort of oil do you use when you're...
We just the W-40.
just give it a little spray.
A little spray, and that's it. And rub it with a towel, and that's it. So that will be ready to tools for the next year. Usually we leave tarps outside. We don't bring them in. Mm-hmm. Usually they are all... But when we, as I mentioned, we have these storage boxes in there, which are also no rodent-proof.
Yeah.
So usually over the winter, when we go the next year, the tarps have been chewed by rodents.
Okay.
So you have to be aware of that. Right. So if you have an expensive tarp, bring it indoors as well. Yeah. You don't want that to be used as a nesting for rodents over the winter.
Yeah.
So that's with how the garden is moving. Last week we talked about mulching. And again, we need to make sure that our composter is topped up with nice brown leaves, mm-hmm. which will at least 2 inches thick. So that will work as a big insulation mat for the earthworms living in the compost.
Right.
Now that we are talking about compost bin, here we use compost bin. We may also make sure that the compost bin, everything around the compost is clean.
Yeah.
And we add lots of mulch, wood chips around, because here in campus, the garden is not a priority for snow cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
So any snow that falls around the composter, which is plastic, we don't want that it gets broken because of the change of temperature.
Right, it's hard on the plastic.
It's hard on the plastic. So we make sure that everything is clean. And when it snows, that's the first thing that we do, clean around the compost bin. Right. So if you have a compost bin at home, make sure that as well everything is clean. And here at the Student Union, we had a compost bin that we placed it on top of a pallet. Mm-hmm. The fact is that if the salt is sprayed, because here all the pots are sprayed with salt for safety reasons, we don't want the salt as well gets in close to the composter or inside the composter.
Right.
So
yeah, that's not going to be good.
Absolutely not. So make sure that it's elevated above ground so the salt that we are spreading wherever you have your compost doesn't get into the composter bin. So those are things that we make sure that they are ready for the winter. As we've been talking as well over this summer, we've been transferring our garden from one place to another.
Yeah.
And that involved carrying a wheelbarrow.
That was a lot of work. A lot of soil.
So we had one wheelbarrow that is six cubic feet of soil that can carry. And after we just walk around 500 meters. No, it's not too far.
Yeah.
But after a few trips, your forearms are blown
because
it's heavy. So since we had to do a lot of work, I managed to get a kind of a straps that you attach to your shoulders.
Yeah.
And those straps go along your arms and that you can have handles. And you put those hoops in the handles
for
the wheelbarrow and...
So you're supporting a lot of the weight on your shoulders instead of your hands and arms.
And yes. So your arms is just for directing the wheelbarrow, but it's not holding the full weight of the wheelbarrow. It's your shoulder that is holding. So that was quite useful. More trips, less pain. And the next day, we could do almost every day quite a few wheelbarrows because without that, I was just able to do a few wheelbarrows at a time. And that was for the day because my arms were all tired. So, yes, just to share with that, so our listeners can realize that there is those tools out there.
Mm-hmm.
You can get that from Amazon. And, yes, it's just a simple strap that you attach to your shoulders, and that can be for your wheelbarrow. For next season, if you have a lot of manure to bring to the garden.
And people will often get a load of soil delivered to set up for, you know, when they're starting their new season or preparing.
Correct. Yeah. So when we start in spring, we get our load of compost, manure, mushroom manure, and that needs to be brought inside the garden. So have this now we have the time to order that, to test, to see how it feels, how it works. Yep. And yeah, so that's one thing. That the other thing that we decided as well to get a Gorilla wagon.
Mm-hmm.
So a very small wagon that we can load in there, and it has four wheels. You just walk with it. It's easy to direct and less strain on your body. Yep. So than a wheelbarrow. Yeah.
So we're in week 44, really pretty much at the end of the season. Is there anything in the garden that you need to, you know, do you have anything still growing that you're harvesting?
At the moment, yes. We have some leeks, yeah, carrots, some kale. It still is growing in there. Yeah. And yeah, so...
And do gardeners need to... Because, I mean, we're really at the point with that frost that's going to... really end things is around the corner,
yes,
if not sooner. Mm-hmm. Do we have to get all those sort of done?
No, really. For instance, leeks, they don't mind the frost,
yeah,
and neither the carrots. The carrot tops will die, yeah, but the roots will stay on the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's just harvesting as we need.
Right.
We don't need to remove everything and leave empty those garden beds. No, we still can keep those over the winter. So, as you know, during this time, most of the plants are switching, removing the water from their cells,
mm-hmm,
and replacing with antifreeze, substance rich in sugars. So that's why all the vegetables over the winter, they are sweeter.
Right.
That's why when you go and pick a carrot over the winter and you bite on it, it's like, oh, this is so sweet. But the plant is keeping it's producing its antifreeze,
yeah,
to survive the winter. So that's something that why the reason is winter vegetables are sweeter.
Oh, nice. All right, well, we're next week's going to be our last episode for this season, because really,
yes,
as we see, things are really winding down, mm-hmm, the garden. We're going to, mm-hmm, talk a bit about planning for the next season, particularly around when you need to start, the sort of schedule and timeline for,
yes,
for getting,
yes,
things rolling. Because, of course, some things start in January, even with seedlings and stuff. So,
yep,
even though you might not be outside in the garden or really even thinking about gardening that much, you do need to sort of, if you really want to start from seeds and stuff, you need to start early. And that can save you a bunch of money, too, right? Going from seeds rather than having to go to
Yeah, so... Yeah, next week we should be talking about our schedule or calendar for the garden calendar for next year. And one of these is just deciding what we are going to plant, what seeds are we going to order, are we going to go in person to collect the seeds, are we going to trust in the post office to be running,
yeah,
all that. We want to go into heirlooms, native plants, where we can get those seeds. So all of that is to consider, and then make our seeding plan. When we start seeding indoors, so we have our vegetables ready outdoors, and yes, it will always save us the money, mm-hmm, when we are growing our own seedlings, because we grow what we like to eat, the varieties that they are not often available in the garden centers,
mm-hmm,
so there could be a kind of lettuce or spinach that you really enjoy, but there is nothing that in, yeah, the garden center, so that's something that we can start very early in the year. And once we have our planning, we say as well when I'm going to start ordering my soil,
mm-hmm,
to add to my garden bed and all that activity. Yeah, so once January arrives, which usually arrives with an awesome weather, spring like,
yeah,
we gardeners are like, yes, now it's time to start gardening. And yeah, sometimes we got too eager and start just doing things in the garden. But yeah, we should have a schedule of things to do month by month.
Excellent. All right. Well, we'll be back next week to talk about all that. Thank you, Pablo Vimas. Tell us a bit about Embark and how people can learn more about it.
So, yeah, Embark is a nonprofit organization based here in SFU. We are a research and education center for our students. And you can find us at the Student Union Building in the room 1310. You can visit our website, embarksustainability.org, or follow us through our social channels at embarksustainability.
All right. Thanks so much, Pablo. Talk to you next week.
See you next week.
Just one more thing before your interview. Can I have your address, please?
I live on Main Street.
I need your exact address.
I live on Main Street.
Oh.
No job, no home. And no home, no job. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to end homelessness.
Welcome back. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is Fund Drive, and we are asking for your support all week long to help support the radio station through our operations throughout the year. Gardening and Bark is one of the segments we bring you every week, locally produced right here at CJSF with the support of the Embark Sustainability Society, one of our colleagues here in the Student Union Building, and, of course, with our expert, Pablo Vimas. And Pablo joins us every week to talk about gardening here in southwest British Columbia with an endless font of tips and wise offerings on successful gardening. One of the many types of programming we have here at CJSF that is worth your support. And if you think so, or really enjoy listening to any of the programming here at CJSF, I hope you'll make a donation. Thanks to Carmen, who donated $50. That is awesome, and we're really excited. We've, like I say, over $700 already just this morning on the first, well, some of it came in before the drive, but we're well on our way towards our goal of $10,000. You can help us reach that goal by making a donation right now. You can go to our website, our Fund Drive website, cjsffunddrive.ca, go directly to the donation page at cjsf.ca/donate. And make a donation now. Any amount is good, but we'd love to see $100 or $120. It's not that much. That's like 30 cents a day or so. That would be terrific. Or you can text 778-782-CJSF. Text the word donate, and you'll get a link back to your phone that you can use to make that donation. Peter, you're going to talk about media.
Yes. Well, the other thing is that I'm going to talk about, and it kind of coincides with media because there's a story, in fact, about Canada and the Philippines signed a status of visiting forces agreement, which I only heard it once on CBC Radio on Sunday. But I, and I'll just go over kind of what I said at the beginning. Today, which was yesterday, this is from the government of Canada. Today, the Canadian Minister of National Defense and the Philippine Secretary of National Defense signs a status of visiting forces agreement between Canada and the Philippines. And I really didn't have time to go a bit in depth on this. It would have been the Philippines is interesting because I think it's the son of Marcos who's now in power.
Uh-huh.
And there's
Ferdinand Marcos.
And we.
And is it Ferdinand Marcos Jr.?
Yes. And Marcos, of course, his wife had all those shoes. Me and Magnus are a bit older to remember this kind of stuff. And it sort of went back towards what it was at one time. The person that took over Marcos, and fortunately, she. It was a better arrangement, but she perhaps did not do as much reform as possible. Divorce is illegal in the Philippines, only in this Vatican City, which is a country, which is really not a city, and it's in Rome itself, but it is a legality of being a country. Well, in the Taiwan and Vatican City, the only countries are not part of the actual UN. Every other country is a member of the United Nations. Just as a side note, but divorce is illegal. If people are tending farms which they don't own, it's a bad situation. So. In the weeks ahead, there's a Philippines group here. Actually, it's kind of across the hall with Embark. And in the future, we'll talk more about this. But it kind of coincides with this. This is sort of an important story, and really haven't heard about it.
Yeah.
Now, so I went to, like, it was a, and it really wasn't a workshop. It was more of a, just a meeting about how you have to get more than one source from the media, from the internet. We're sort of going away from being the newspapers, magazines, the internet are becoming a force. And there is a problem. I've had a problem in the last 2.25 years. It's been pretty good. I think that this, the kind of reporting I'm doing, which is very interesting, which is almost entirely internet-based, would not have been done, I think, 30 years ago, because it just wouldn't have had the resources that you have on the internet to get the information. But there are, like I made an error about a year and a half ago about, it was from John Oliver, who sort of does that little comedy thing.
Yeah.
And he said something that was wrong. He said that Hillary Clinton was for having people in Haiti having a lower wage or whatever it was. And I just went with what he said, and I maybe I've made other errors. Hopefully not, but I had the I made a retraction on this. You hear a lot about the legacy media. Well, I'm sort of not big on the legacy media because Time Magazine. I got a book from the library. It's actually. I wanted to get something a bit better, but this is from 2004. Magazines that made history. It's got Time. They got 8 magazines. Yeah. Time, Life, People, National Geographic, and 3 European ones.
Right. We got like 2 minutes.
Well, anyway, People magazine has from the onset done the most shallow kind of reporting, kind of emphasizing shallowness. By the way, Life magazine.
Although that was its point.
Yeah, it was the point, but it's part of the Time Life. And Life magazine ended as a weekly because of postage rates. It went up too much in 1972. And it wasn't that it wasn't successful as it were. It was just that the postal rates would have made it more expensive. So right. That's why it was discontinued. And there's a big difference between Life and People. Life, which started in 1936, was not so emphasis on celebrity, which not that it didn't have Marilyn Monroe on the cover every once in a while. It was perhaps more show busy than, but it was sort of a bad emphasis in our culture that it went from Life magazine, People came 1974. And in this chapter on People, it sort of says they kind of go out of their way to be shallow, actually. And they were saying that because People's part of Time, Time Life or whatever you want to call it, that the people in Time magazine looked down on the reporters of People magazine. They got kind of upset about this,
right,
and so on. But I think they had a right to look down on them. Maybe they were stuck with that job, I guess. But one thing about People is that supposedly celebrity dead is the best thing for them. When a celebrity dies, that'll because they made a big error. What was Elvis supposedly? When Elvis died, they had Morty Feldman on the cover of somebody, and they missed out.
Right.
So they made it up ever since. Anyway, so oh, by the way, there was. I was surprised. Somebody once said, "There's nothing older than yesterday's newspaper," and the guy lived from 1927, and he died in 1989.
Yeah.
And I thought it was an older expression. It's actually it's more of a longer thing. It's based on a longer statement he right. made. But I was a bit surprised that's not as old of a statement as I would have thought.
All right. Thanks for that, Peter. You've been listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tewald. Joining me in the studio here was Peter R.H. And we also had Stephen Fan in the studio earlier as well. It's Fun Drive time. I hope you will make a donation this week. CJSF.ca/donate is where you can go to make a donation right now. Democracy Now! Is up in a few minutes. We are the only station that broadcasts Democracy Now! At a reasonable time of day and on the same day. I think that's special. And Amy Goodman will want you to make a donation to CJSF because she's a big supporter of community radio, and that's why she makes the show available to us and others.